Content warning. The novel featured in this episode contains themes of domestic violence. We all present different versions of ourselves to different people, in different situations and at different times in our lives. Typically, these are just small variations upon the image we carry in our own minds, our own self-image. But imagine if a person's self-image is so grotesquely misaligned with the truth of that person's soul. How dangerous is a man who believes, deep in his heart of hearts, that he is the hero, while his evil infects and corrupts everything and everyone around him? Can anyone be redeemed without first looking into their own dark mirror? The blood. Nightsoth looked at his father for several seconds before speaking to him in a voice that was dripping with contempt. It seems to me that as a bard and a milkmaid, neither of the two products of your affairs would have been the type inclined to claim it. Perhaps not, Anglesoth said, but if they had known of their lineage, known of their birthright, then perhaps. It's of little consequence now, Caradoc said flatly. They are both dead. Yes, said Ankle, nodding. Thank you. For what? Asked Caradoc, doing nothing to stop his voice from rising in anger. He was loyal to Nightsoth, not to the knight's father, who was nothing more than a second-rate clerk and a first-rate philanderer. For the murder of your own flesh and blood, the half-kin of my master? If the elder Soth was surprised by the young man's impertinence, he did not show it. Why? For the removal of the black marks upon my soul, Ankle answered, his voice still strong, still confident. The black marks might have been removed from your soul, said Nightsoth, but they are not gone. They have merely been transferred. The black marks that were once upon your soul are now upon mine. The full weight of my father's sins are now mine alone to bear. What a lovely gift to receive scant months before my wedding day. Soth knew that the evil deeds were necessary to assure his ascension to the lordship of Dargard Keep, and he would let nothing interfere with that, but he resented the fact that his father had made such murders necessary. The sarcasm in young Soth's words was too much for the elder Soth to bear. He turned away from his son in order to avoid having to look him in the face. You might not have been a knight of Salamnia, said Knight Soth, but you were familiar enough with the oath and the measure to have at least tried to live by its code. I was never suited to become a knight, nor to live like one, Ankle said, his voice sad and apologetic. His face appeared to have aged over the last few minutes, with the realization that his son would likely never forgive him his past indiscretions. A poor excuse. Perhaps, but it's the only one I have. Nightsoth turned to face the older man. Goodbye, father, he said, knowing that the words were much more than just a casual farewell. The elder Soth looked at his son for a long time, and the disgrace he felt slowly disappeared. A cynical, almost mocking smile appeared on his face. Don't be so quick to condemn me, my son. You are of my flesh and of my blood. You always will be. Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be discussing Lord Soth by Ado Van Belcombe, published in 1997 by TSR Incorporated, the sixth novel in the Dragonlance Warrior series. I know I said in the last episode that we'd be discussing Knight of the Black Rose, but I've decided to discuss Lord Soth first. Although it was published later, I think Soth's story is more effective told in this order. And I also know that I'm deviating from the Ravenloft setting back into the Dragonlance setting, but just bear with me. It will all fit together nicely. As always, this episode will contain spoilers, so stop listening now if you'd rather read the novel first. I'll also be spoiling parts of Dragons of Spring Dawning and Test of the Twins, both from the Dragonlance series, so consider yourself spoiler alerted. Lord Soth is the story of how a noble and chivalrous knight, Lord Loren Soth of Dargard Keep, became the infamous Death Knight known far and wide as the Knight of the Black Rose. But before we dive into that, I want to try to straighten out the confusing history of Lord Soth after death. The first novel Soth appears in is the third novel of the Chronicles trilogy, Dragons of Spring Dawning, by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. They created him. He is their baby. I make special mention of this because the issue of who owns Lord Soth as an intellectual property will come up for debate. In the novel, the Dragon High Lord Kitiara Uthmatar is licking her wounds after being routed at the Battle of the High Claris Tower, thanks to the efforts of the Knight of Salamnia named Sturm Brightblade. Sturm sacrificed his life to give the elf princess Larana a chance to use the magical dragon orb to lure the evil dragons attacking the tower into a fatal trap. The loss is devastating to Kitiara's personal fortune because her commander, the Dragon High Lord Ariakas, does not tolerate failure in his subordinates. Kitiara retreats to the ancient fortress called Dargar Keep, which has been abandoned since the Cataclysm and allowed to go to ruin. The keep was once one of the great architectural wonders of Kryn, having been built in the shape of a rose to honor the Order of the Rose, the highest order within the honorable and virtuous Knights of Salamnia. Kitiara has made the fortress her new headquarters, and Ariakas pursues her there, intending to execute her for failing to take the High Claris Tower. Ariakas has been looking for an excuse to do so, since Kitiara is the only Dragon High Lord as ruthless as he is, and thus the greatest threat to his position. Ariakas finds Kitiara in her bedchamber and is about to behead her when he is prevented in doing so by a creature from beyond the grave, a Death Knight, Lord Soth. As it turns out, Kitiara has made an alliance with Soth. He has become her enforcer and her personal bodyguard. Not only does he protect her from Ariakas, he later helps her capture her great nemesis, the Golden General Larana. So what does Soth get out of this arrangement? Well, Kitiara will present Larana to the Queen of Darkness as a gift. Assuming that Takisus will allow Kitiara to dispose of Larana however she wishes, Kitiara will ask the goddess to transform Larana into an undead companion for Soth. Soth, we will learn, has a thing for blonde elf chicks. The entire plan goes awry thanks to Tanis Half-Elven and Raistlin Majeer. Tanis kills Ariakas, claims the Crown of Power for himself, and rescues Larana. As they flee, the dragon armies turn on one another. Kitiara will eventually triumph, thanks in no small part to Soth. But what about his prize? It's no matter. Soth has fixated on a new woman, Kitiara herself. By the way, the later novel, Dragons of the High Lord Skies, details how Kitiara and Soth met and became allies. I highly recommend it. I also recommend just Googling the cover art because it has my favorite depiction of Lord Soth and my favorite depiction of a blue dragon in one. So, what is a Death Knight? If your only experience with Death Knights is Warcraft, you'll want to set those expectations aside. A Death Knight within the lore of Dungeons & Dragons is a fallen paladin, cursed to exist beyond death as a force of evil and destruction, as punishment for failing to uphold the oath they swore in life. In Soth's case, the Oaths of a Knight of the Rose. Soth has the appearance of a Knight of Salamnia in antiquated plate armor, but the armor has been burned black. He wears a purple cape, also burned and tattered. Typically, he is depicted wearing his iconic full helm with only his eyes, two burning points of orange light visible. He can appear solid or he can appear incorporeal as he chooses. Beneath his armor, he is depicted as a blackened skeleton with bits of charred flesh still clinging to it. A Death Knight is one of the most dangerous undead creatures a party can face, capable of wielding extremely powerful magic in addition to their skill with weapons. Soth also has 13 skeletal warriors at his command, who served him loyally in life and are thus cursed to serve him in death. He also has a few banshees hanging around the keep, who sing the song of his downfall to him every night before bedtime. In battle, he rides a demonic horse called a nightmare. Nightmare. Get it? Soth returns in the Legends trilogy, still ostensibly loyal to Kitiara, but now he has far different motives. His plan is to orchestrate Kitiara's death so he can claim her soul and bind her to him in undeath for all time. As icing on the wedding cake, he also wants revenge upon the city of Palanthas, the city where he was condemned to death during his lifetime. Soth can't kill Kitiara himself or else the binding ritual will fail, so he arranges for her to be killed by the dark elf Dalimar. Soth's plan succeeds. In the climactic battle at the Tower of High Sorcery in Palanthas in Test of the Twins, Dalimar kills Kitiara and Soth appears to claim her body, much to the dismay of her former lover, Tanis Half-Elven, and her half-brother, Caramon Majeer. but there is nothing that any of them, even Dalimar, can do to stop a Death Knight. That's the last we see of Lord Soth in the Dragonlance setting for a long time. Soth was so popular that TSR decided to transplant him into the Ravenloft setting in his own trilogy of novels. The first was Knight of the Black Rose, which we'll be discussing in the next episode. The second was Spectre of the Black Rose, which we will also be discussing soon. The third, well, there wasn't a third. Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman were not happy about their character being removed from Kryn, and it led to a dispute over who owned the rights to the character, the authors who created him, or the company that owned the rights to the Dragonlance novels. We'll discuss the fallout of this conflict in later episodes. I know I've said this before in other episodes, but Lord Soth is one of my absolute favorite fantasy villains. He's just so cool and so badass. And, like Strahd, his story is a compelling one. He's clearly evil and a dick, but you can kind of sympathize with his tragic downfall. If you read the Annotated Chronicles and Legends trilogy, Weis and Hickman describe how Soth needed to be used sparingly because he was just such a powerful presence in any scene that he drew all the attention away from the other characters. When an author is losing control over their own character, you know you've got something special. Now to round out all this lore with a bit of obscure trivia. Lord Soth appears in two different video games. He appears in the 1990 PC game, Death Knights of Kryn, and the 1996 PlayStation 1 game, Iron and Blood, Warriors of Ravenloft. You can't play as him, though. Such a waste. Alrighty, that's enough backstory. Let's jump into, well, Soth's backstory, and begin our discussion of Lord Soth. Lord Soth begins with murder. In the streets of the city of Calaman, a dark and shadowy figure hunts and kills a young bard, before departing the city and making for an outlying town. There, the killer finds a young milkmaid, sleeping peacefully in a cottage. Like the bard, she meets with a violent death by the killer's hand. The only thing these two unsuspecting victims have in common is that they are both half-elven, and both bear a striking family resemblance. His grim business finished, the killer stalks off into the night for his next rendezvous. This last meeting is not with another victim, but with his employer, Sir Loren Soth, Knight of the Sword. The murderer is Caradoc, a Knight of the Crown, Soth's personal steward and most stalwart follower. He would do anything his master commanded, even commit cold-blooded murder. There is another man present, however, Soth's father, Ankel Soth. The two half-elves were both Ankel Soth's illegitimate children, and their deaths were ordered by his one legitimate heir. The younger Soth ordered Caradoc to kill Soth's half-brother and sister to prevent any opposing claim to his title. The younger Soth scorns his father for being a worthless philanderer and a general waste of a human being, blaming his father for forcing his hand with his reckless ways. The younger Soth feels no remorse for what he's done, laying the responsibility squarely on his father. If the elder Soth had just kept it in his pants, there would have been no murders necessary. But the elder Soth reminds his son that they share blood and whatever darkness pollutes it. With this unpleasant business behind him, Soth determines to get on with his life. After all, life is good. His new fortress, Dargard Keep, has just recently been finished and is finally ready to become his personal residence. The fortress is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the great feats of building on all of Ancelon. Soth comes from a long line of distinguished and noble Knights of the Rose, his father being the rare exception, and this keep is meant to honor his forebears as well as all the famous Knights of Salamnia who came before him. Soth himself is promoted from the rank of Knight of the Sword to Knight of the Rose. Typically, the process of ascending to the highest rank of knighthood requires a long list of specific accomplishments, but Soth is so popular and his lineage so well regarded that these formalities are waived. After all, most of Ancelon is unified under the influence of the holy city of Istar, and all-out warfare is rare. When the official ceremony is complete, he is no longer Sir Soth, but Lord Soth of Dargard Keep. The ceremony is attended by many luminaries from the surrounding country. As always, Soth's 13 loyal retainers, including Caradoc, are there to cheer him on, and also the Lady Corinne Gladria, Soth's bride-to-be. She considers herself the luckiest woman in the world to be marrying such a virtuous man, a man who, by all reckoning, should have a bright future ahead of him. And Soth considers himself to be the luckiest man in the world to be marrying a woman as beautiful and chaste as Lady Corinne, who also happens to have an enormous dowry. The wedding takes place soon after Soth's promotion. The day of the wedding is rainy, an ill omen, but Soth decides to proceed with the wedding anyway. After the ceremony, the weather clears and everyone begins to celebrate. Soth's knights celebrate with sparring contests, including one between Caradoc and a knight named Meyer Serral. During the fight, Caradoc feigns an injury. Serral relaxes his guard as he checks to make sure Caradoc is not hurt, and Caradoc retaliates, wounding Serral and ending the contest. This almost leads to a real fight, but the officiator of the contest, one Sir Orin Brightblade, declares the issue a simple accident. He reasons that Caradoc is a knight of Salamnia, and no knight of Salamnia would knowingly use such underhanded tactics. Apparently, this logic convinces everyone. Only one other incident mars the festivities. Lord Soth spots his new bride talking to a knight whom Soth doesn't recognize. He remains hidden to spy on them. He sees the young knight kiss Lady Corinne before he departs. That night, in their bedchambers, Soth asks his wife who the young knight was. Corinne explains that it was an old family friend whom she was saying goodbye to. The kiss was a platonic gesture between two friends. Soth decides to trust his wife and lets his jealousy fade, for now. Now that Soth has been given his promotion, finished building his new home, married his sweetheart, and murdered his siblings, he settles into lordly life. Unfortunately, dealing with the mundane tasks of administration doesn't suit him, and he soon grows bored. Worse, his wife stubbornly refuses to become pregnant, no matter how hard he works to impregnate her. So Soth is thrilled to hear that a party of ogres have attacked a village called Halton and killed several villagers. Finally, he'll have something worthwhile to do. Soth and his knights are armored and equipped and given a send-off like they're going to fight the Dark Queen herself, not a band of ogre raiders. Along the journey, Soth has the first of a series of recurring nightmares, in which he has visions of a son yet to be born, dying in pain and fear, with Soth himself unable to rescue him. Back in the waking world, the knights eventually reach the troubled village of Halton. After questioning two villagers who have escaped and were found hiding in the woods, Soth learns the layout of the town and lays out a battle plan. One of the sword knights, Sir Colm Farrell, will lead a group to rescue the villagers, who have been imprisoned by the ogres. Caradoc and Sir Worston Kern will outflank the ogres where they have gathered in the town square. Soth himself will lead the remainder of the knights in a direct charge. The plan succeeds brilliantly. Sir Farrell and his men find one sleeping ogre guarding the prisoners. Since it's against the knightly code of ethics to attack an enemy unaware, they wake up the ogre before attacking and easily dispatch him to rescue the villagers. Soth and his men attack on horseback, scattering the ogres, driving many to flight. Then they dismount and fight the remaining ogres on foot. Meanwhile, Caradoc finds an ogre hiding in the forest and attacks. Sir Kern appears, inadvertently distracting the ogre. While it's not looking, Caradoc strikes it in the back of the skull, killing it. The two knights rejoin their comrades, and the group celebrate their victory along with the grateful people of Halton. That night, Soth has another nightmare. This time, he comes home to Dargard Keep and catches Lady Corinne in bed with another man. Enraged, Soth murders the man, only to realize that the man he has murdered is himself. He wakes in a cold sweat. Soth and his men return to the keep as heroes, and Soth is greeted warmly by his faithful wife. The winter months tick by at Dargard Keep as Lord and Lady Soth attempt to conceive, but fail each time. Lord Soth begins to fear that he made a mistake in marrying Lady Corinne, that for all her beauty and wealth, she is barren. She will never be able to give him what he wants most, a son. And still, his nightmares continue night after night. When winter ends, Soth plans to travel to the city of Palanthas with some of his knights for an annual gathering of Knights of Salamnia. The trip is expected to be uneventful since the roads are well-traveled, and the efforts of the King Priest of Istar to eradicate all evil from Kryn have been quite successful lately, ever since he issued the so-called Edict of Manifest Virtue. The edict basically calls for the destruction of evil in all its forms on Kryn. It started with the attempted extermination of the quote-unquote evil races, like goblins and ogres, naturally. But the King Priest in his infinite wisdom has recently issued a new edict, the Edict of Thought Control, reasoning that evil deeds are caused by evil thoughts, and thus an evil thought deserves a swift and severe punishment, just as an evil deed does. To this end, he has recruited white-robed mages to read the thoughts of the people of Istar and report those who think evil thoughts to the proper religious authorities. But there's still plenty of evil deeds to be found if one is unlucky enough. As the knights travel, they hear a woman screaming and immediately leap into action. They find a group of elven women under attack by a party of ogres. These ogres aren't like the drunken fools who attacked Halton. They are much more desperate and dangerous. Soth and his men are victorious, however. Soth personally saves a beautiful young elf maiden named Isolde Dennison from the clutches of a particularly fiendish ogre and is immediately smitten with her. Apparently, old Ankle Soth isn't the only Soth who likes pointy ears. As it turns out, the elf women are from Sylvanesti, traveling to Palanthas on a holy pilgrimage to become revered daughters of Paladine. Side note, not only is there no Temple of Paladine in Palanthas, as explicitly stated in Time of the Twins, Istar itself is actually much closer to Sylvanesti than Palanthas is. Apparently, the elves didn't bother to read Time of the Twins, or a map. Regardless, the day is saved and all is well. The elf women can now continue on to Palanthas, accompanied by their gallant rescuers. But Soth has other plans. He is concerned that Isolde might die from her sprained ankle, so he insists that he take her back to Dargard Keep to be tended by his personal healer, Istvan. The leader of the elves, an older woman, at first refuses such an outrageous suggestion, until she realizes that this isn't just an ordinary human, it's Lord Soth, Knight of the Rose, famous across Ancelon for his trustworthiness. She gives her permission, and the two travel back to Dargard Keep. Apparently, Soth's attraction to Isolde is mutual, and she kisses him. Soth is torn between this attraction to her and his duty towards his lady wife. Still, he presses on with his plan. The two return to the keep, and Lady Corrin is thrilled to see what her husband has brought home with him. Isolde remains at Dargard Keep to recover from her fake injuries. She and Soth grow closer as Soth and Corrin grow farther apart. One day, a maidservant named Miral spots Soth and Isolde kissing and runs to tattle to her mistress. Corrin is devastated and decides the only way she can keep her husband faithful is to have his child by any means necessary. She asks a young knight, who is in the service of her family rather than Soth's, to complete a secret task, to travel to the castle of her cousin and ask her cousin to summon Soth on quote-unquote urgent business. The young knight agrees. Meanwhile, the elven women whom the knights rescued are now making the return journey from Palanthas to Sylvanesti and stop at Dargard Keep to pick up Isolde. She refuses to leave, and the elder elf woman correctly deduces why. When Soth is away on his fake mission, Lady Corrin and her maidservant Mirel sneak out of the keep and into the foothills of the Dargard Mountains. There, they find the cottage of a notable hedge witch. Corrin asks the crone to use her magic to give her a child by her husband. The witch has the power to do as Corrin asks, but she warns the noblewoman that, if she grants such a request, she may not be pleased with the outcome. The cost of the magic is such that the child, when born, will reflect the soul of his father. If the father is a righteous man, the baby will be born strong and healthy. If the father is a wicked man, well, Corrin isn't fazed by this. Soth is a good man, after all. The witch is a little more dubious. Regardless, Corrin insists, and the witch grants her request. Soth returns home from his pointless expedition and is overjoyed when Lady Corrin tells him she is with child. The entire keep celebrates the news that a little baby Soth will soon be born. Everyone except Isolde. She tells Soth that it is time for her to return to Sylvanesti. Now that Soth has everything he wants, there's no reason for her to remain at Dargard Keep. Soth is distraught at this suggestion and pleads that she remain. Isolde doesn't need much convincing and agrees. And it's a good thing she does, because the pregnancy does not go well. Corrin is in almost constant pain for months on end. There's nothing Soth can do about it except to have sex with Isolde. At last, Corrin goes into labor. The labor, like the pregnancy itself, is long and difficult. When at last the baby is born, Istvan the healer tries to keep Soth from seeing his child. Soth demands to see his son, and Istvan has no choice but to relent. When at last Soth sees the thing lying in the bassinet, he decides this creature could not possibly be his spawn. Overcome with a cold rage, he orders Istvan to leave the room. When it's all over, he orders Caradoc to dispose of the bodies. Corrin and the infant are hastily cremated. Soth concocts a story to suggest that the mother and the child died of some disease and needed to be cremated instead of properly buried to prevent the disease from spreading. Of course, Lady Corrin's relatives are outraged. Outrage piles upon outrage when Soth hastily remarries Isolde, who is obviously already pregnant. Less than 9 months later, Isolde gives birth to a healthy half-elf baby boy, and at last Soth seems happy. Miral, formerly Corrin's maidservant and now Isolde's, suspects the truth of what happened to her mistress. After all, she was the only one who knew that Soth and Isolde were romantically involved before Corrin's death, and she's the only one who knew of the witch's prophecy. She has begun to whisper around the keep, and the rumor is beginning to spread. Miral tells Isolde what she believed happened to the former Lady Soth and what may happen to the new one, but Isolde refuses to believe her and banishes her from the keep. Miral travels to Planthus, to the home of Layla Gladria, Corrin's mother. The odd circumstances of Corrin's death and cremation give credence to what Miral tells her about what became of her daughter and grandson. Lady Gladria takes Miral to see High Justice Kaladin, the highest-ranking judge among the Salamnic Order. He listens to what Miral has to say and, even though she is only a lowly maid accusing a rose knight, Lord Kaladin has been hearing rumors circulating from Dargard Keep with too great a frequency and consistency to ignore. He summons Lord Soth to Palanthus. Soth arrives in Palanthus with six of his knights, unaware of the true reason for which he's been summoned. He sends his knights to wait for him at an inn while he travels with a group of Lord Kaladin's knights he assumes are a kind of honor guard. Once Soth is separated from his retainers, however, he is accosted by the knights and taken to the High Justice. There, he is informed that he will stand trial for the murder of his wife and newborn. The first witness to testify against him is Miral, followed by the elder elf woman to whom Isolde admitted the true nature of her relationship with Soth. Lastly, Istvan the healer is summoned. Lord Soth is confident that Istvan is his man, so confident, in fact, that Soth will allow Istvan's testimony to be accepted as the primary evidence for his innocence. At first, things go well. Istvan maintains the fiction Soth crafted for him. For a moment, it seems like Soth might be acquitted. But then a white-robed mage is summoned to participate in the proceedings. The mage casts a spell which forces Istvan to tell the truth, whatever that truth might be. Istvan has no choice but to reverse his testimony and admit that both Lady Corrin and the baby survived the birth. Soth is found guilty. He is stripped of his knighthood and his rank and condemned to death by beheading for murder, the sentence to be carried out the following day. Caradoc and Soth's other knights hear what has happened and are devastated. They can't believe their lord could be guilty of something as evil as killing his own wife and child. Except Caradoc, of course. He was there, after all. But Caradoc knows that he will lose all status without Soth and will lose his privileged position as steward of a great keep. Worse, his role in Soth's crimes might be exposed. So Caradoc convinces the other knights that their lord can't possibly be guilty, that this must be some gruesome miscarriage of justice. The next day, Soth is put in a cart and driven through the streets of Palanthus to the execution place. The citizens gather on the street to watch him pass. They jeer, throw rotten vegetables and garbage and even dung, and Soth is soon covered in filth. He swears that he will somehow, someday, get his revenge upon Palanthus and its people. At last, the cart reaches the square where he is to be executed. Before the sentence can be carried out, however, Soth's knights launch a surprise attack and rescue Soth. The group fights its way through the surprised knights guarding Soth and flee the city. Soth and his knights ride into the mountains and disappear. Once they are certain their pursuers have lost their trail, they travel across the country toward Dargard Keep. Of course, the knights are waiting for him, but Soth is able to break through and make it safely back to his fortress. Once inside, he is untouchable, but he is a prisoner as well. There is nowhere he can go where he will not be captured or killed on sight. he can only remain in the keep and brood. And brood he does. He even strikes Isolde at one point. Meanwhile, their child continues to grow, but the baby brings little comfort to Soth. He knows the baby will be accursed because of what he has done. The half-elven son of a disgraced knight and convicted murderer can never hope for a happy life. Isolde hasn't given up hope, though. She spends hours in the chapel praying to the goddess Mishakal to offer her husband a way to redeem himself. One night, the goddess answers, appearing to Isolde in a dream, and tells her of a calamity which will soon strike Ancelon. You see, while the story of Soth's downfall was playing out in Salamnia, over in Istar, the king priest's ego has inflated to gargantuan proportions. He has come to believe that he is a god in human form, and that the other gods must accept him into their ranks. When they refuse to do so, which is probably a wise decision on their part, the king priest threatened them, claiming that he was a true ruler of Kryn, not them. The gods don't like such talk. They have begun sending warnings to the people of Kryn in the form of bizarre occurrences, like mysterious unnatural floods, fires, and storms, among other even less explicable phenomena. Mishakal warns Isolde that soon the cataclysm will strike Ancelon and wipe the slate clean of Istar and its corrupting influence. But the goddess offers an alternative. If Lord Soth will travel to Istar, the gods will grant him the power to destroy the king priest and avert the cataclysm. Countless lives will be spared and Soth's honor will be restored, but he will lose his life in the process. That is the only way he can be redeemed and the only way the cataclysm can be stopped. Isolde tells her husband about her dream and what must be done. As much as it pains her, she knows he must go to Issar and sacrifice his life, rather than remain at Dargard Keep as a disgraced husk of a man, so that his soul can be saved. Soth is moved by the power of her conviction and agrees he must do as the goddess has commanded. He says goodbye to his wife and his son and departs Dargard Keep, accompanied only by Caradoc, Sir Ferald, and Sir Kern, his three most loyal followers, never to return. Or at least, that's what should have happened. Instead, Soth and his men are met along the road by three elf women. Not the same elf women they met before, I don't think so anyway, it's not entirely clear. Regardless, these elf women are servants of the king priest. The king priest's psychic spies are aware of what Soth intends and know all about his crimes, even the murders of his half-siblings. The elf women mock Soth as a disgrace and a traitor and mock his men for continuing to follow a murderer. This alone would not be enough to stop Soth and his quest, but the elf women have one last card to play. They suggest to Lord Soth that Isolde has been unfaithful to him and that her son is not really his. Their words trigger Soth's deadly jealousy. They know the truth about him. They must know the truth about Isolde as well. After all, she seduced him when she was married. She lay with him while his wife was in labor. Why wouldn't she shrink from lying with another man? Kryn could not conceive a child by Soth until she saw the Hedge Witch. Why was Isolde able to conceive so easily? Because he was not the real father. And why was she so eager to send him to Istar to face certain death? Because of a dream she had? Perhaps it was all a ruse to get him out of the picture so she could find a better man. And honestly, who could blame her? In a rage, Soth abandons his quest and rides back to Dargard Keep, his men pursuing. Back at the keep, Soth confronts Isolde, demanding to know who the baby's real father is. She denies his accusations, and he attacks her, knocking her to the floor with the baby in her arms. At that moment, the cataclysm strikes. A fiery mountain falls from the sky and destroys Istar. The entire continent is shaken by violent earthquakes. In the Great Hall of Dargard Keep, the shaking causes the chandelier to fall. Isolde is impaled on its spikes. The fire of the candles catches her dress and she begins to burn. She begs Soth to save their baby, but he turns his back on her. The fire begins to spread, soon engulfing the entire keep. Caradoc, Kern, and Ferald return just in time to see it begin to blaze like a torch. Loyal to the end, the three men decide to join their lord in death. As the fire rampages through the building, Isolde calls out a curse upon Lord Soth. She curses him to rise from the dead and to live one life for every life his folly has cost. One life for every life lost in the cataclysm. All around Dargard Keep, People cry out to their Lord to save them, but he ignores them all. He sits down on his seat at the center of the great hall and allows the fire to consume him. He dies in the flames, only to live again as a cursed monstrosity, a death knight. The servants of the castle who died in the fire linger on as ghosts. Soth's 13 retainers are transformed into skeletal warriors condemned to serve him. The 3 elven women who tricked Soth on the road to Istar also rise from the dead as banshees, only to be bound to the man they once tormented. Each night, they sing their ghoulish song, recounting the story of his downfall, the story of Lord Soth, the Knight of the Black Rose. That was Lord Soth by Ado Van Belcombe. I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I reread this novel for this podcast. I haven't read it in about 15 years, and my memory of it was that it was a decent book, but nothing to write home about, certainly nothing to podcast about. I remembered it as a serviceable and basically successful attempt to tell the story of Lord Soth's downfall without too many frills or liberties. But reading it now, I think I enjoyed it more than I expected to. It's direct and clearly written, telling the story it needed to tell to fit all the lore that had been developed around Soth for more than a decade, and it does so without contradicting anything, at least anything I can remember. Everything fits together nicely. And that's quite an achievement all on its own. I do have a few complaints, such as my earlier complaint about the elves traveling to Palanthas instead of Istar. Little continuity breaks like that are often unavoidable when sharing a world with so many authors across so many books, unfortunately. And I also thought it was weirdly uncreative to have 2 separate battles with 2 separate groups of ogres, but perhaps the author's hands were tied by earlier lore. Overall, it's an enjoyable story, if a story about a man murdering 2 wives and 2 children can be called enjoyable. It's definitely intended to be read as a kind of tragedy rather than a high fantasy epic or a swords and sorcery adventure. For most of the story, Soth stays put in a single location, Dargard Keep, with only brief excursions to nearby locales and a trip to Palanthas, and most of the drama comes from character interactions rather than scenes of battle. After all, we know what's going to happen at the end. The entertainment comes from seeing how it all unfolds. Lord Soth is a fascinating character, despite his disregard for human life. That's why he's such a great villain. No matter what horrific act he's committing, you can't help but watch him. I think that Van Belcombe made an excellent decision to portray Soth as a man unable to contain his pride, his lust, his jealousy, and his rage. There's times when he's practically seething with fury you can almost feel. This is in complete contrast to the Lord Soth we meet in Dragons of Spring Dawning. Undead, Lord Soth is as cold and passionless as it's possible to be, except for the occasional flare of his burning eyes. Soth's death burned out all the passion and left only the black emptiness of his wicked soul behind. I also like how Van Belcombe portrayed the King Priest of Istar in a few brief scenes interspersed with Lord Soth's story. The King Priest serves as an excellent foil for Soth, as the two have much in common. Both men are, to outward appearances, the highest ideal of goodness and light, yet both men are, in truth, narcissistic and arrogant and utterly oblivious to the path of self-destruction they are walking. I also appreciate that Van Belcombe portrays the King Priest and Istarian society in general in such a way that you can really grasp why the gods thought destroying him and Istar was necessary. There's parts of the novel that are difficult to get through, especially as a female reader. Soth's contempt for women is readily apparent. He sees Corinne as nothing more than a means to acquire more wealth and an heir. He sees Isolde as a plaything to keep him occupied when his wife's difficult and complicated pregnancy turns her into a total bummer. And of course, he ultimately sees both women as his property, to use as he sees fit and discard as he sees fit. Hundreds of years later, he will see Kitiara the same way too. This might be a weird comparison, but I kept thinking about the killer Drew Peterson as I was writing this episode. If you don't know the name, Drew Peterson is a former Illinois cop who is convicted of killing his wife and is suspected of killing another wife. It's not just the fact that Peterson and Soth are both murderers of multiple wives, they both share this slimy sense of entitlement. During the trial scene, Soth is furious that the High Justice believes the testimony of two lowly women over his. It's like, bro, you know you did it. How are you going to get mad at these women for telling the truth and the judge for believing it? But that's how the mind of an egomaniac works, I suppose. Sidebar, the scene in which Soth kills Corinne and their baby is extremely brutal. It happens off camera, but that actually kind of makes it worse. You only get Caradoc's impressions of the aftermath, and that's more than enough. This portrayal of a realistic, earthly evil is perfectly executed, not only in the character of Soth, but in the character of Caradoc, too. Caradoc is supposed to be a gallant knight, but he's secretly an assassin. He's supposed to follow the knightly code, but he breaks it whenever it benefits him to do so. He even betrays his comrades, tricking them into rescuing Soth and ultimately leading them to their own damnation, just because he himself doesn't want to lose his privileged position. The interesting thing about Caradoc is how unfeeling he is about it. He's not consumed by his emotions the way Soth is. Caradoc doesn't seem to have any emotions at all. He is a pure sociopath. Whether he's committing murder or sucker-punching ogres or disposing of dead bodies, we never get any flicker of what's really going on in Caradoc's mind. He doesn't seem to enjoy committing murder. He doesn't seem to not enjoy committing murder. It's a job, and he does it without the slightest introspection or reflection. In a way, Caradoc and Soth are perfect for each other. They're both equally evil, just different types of evil. I want to point out that, although this book has two of its female protagonists murdered, there are a few strong female characters as well. Lady Galadriel, Myril the Handmaiden, Ulcilla Sterling, the leader of the Elven Clerics, even the Hedge Witch, they all see right through Lord Soth, even when none of the wise and powerful knights do. And that brings us to Isolde. She's an interesting character. She starts as this kind of lovesick girl who wants nothing more than to carve L.S. Love's I.D. into the trunks of trees. As the story progresses, she begins to feel conflicted about her relationship with Soth, but not conflicted enough to break it off. She knows what she's doing is wrong, but she does it anyway. When Lord Soth is convicted of murder, she stands by him. His guilt or innocence doesn't matter. She loves him regardless. Loves him enough to pray nightly for his redemption. Her faith and her love are almost, almost enough to save him. But there's a line, and Soth crosses that line when he refuses to save their baby. Perhaps Isolde has a moment of clarity when she realizes that no amount of love could have saved Soth. He was a monster even before he was undead. In her last moments, she unleashes the ultimate curse upon him, a curse he well and truly deserves. Okay, that's all for this episode. Be sure to tune in next time when we will begin the first of Lord Soth's Ravenloft stories, Knight of the Black Rose. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at dndbookclub@gmail.com. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. Or you can follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. If you'd like to support the podcast, please go to patreon.com/dndbookclub and become a subscriber. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, never let toxic masculinity ruin your party.